August 23rd, 2008, the Norris Group is hosting the event I Survived Real Estate 2008 at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. Proceeds from the event will benefit the Orange County affiliate of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure. The event seeks to bring together the real estate community, including realtors, auctioneers, investors, mortgage professionals, economists, data providers, and builders to discuss how we got here, how the respective industries are changing, and how we move forward and prosper together in 2008 and 2009. The event would not be possible without the generous help of the following partners: the San Diego Creative Investment Association and President Bill Tan, the Investors Workshops of Orange County and President Sean Watkins, Fry Wiles, the web development, internet marketing, and creative design firm, helping launch the event site isurvived2008.com, Proxibid, who will be airing the event live over the internet for those unable to attend live, the Nixon Library, our good friends at MVT Productions, who always take care of our audio-video needs, and White House Catering, whose master chef will be providing the three-course meal for this black tie event. The following radio interview is in preparation for the live event.
Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. With us today is Anna Maria Allen. She's president and founder of and CEO of the Compliance Group. Anna Maria has an extensive 20-year background in the mortgage lending industry and has worked for several large financial institutions as compliance manager and in mortgage banking. Anna Maria, we welcome you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Our current foreclosure mess, was it caused by lenders not following guidelines or having guidelines that were so lax it allowed it to happen?
Oh, that's a good question. These are my opinions.
No, that's okay. That's why you're here.
So I'm just going to lay them out there.
Okay.
You know, I'm probably going to say it's a combination of both.
I would agree with that.
You know, I think that over the past 10 years, our lending industry has changed so much, and we've gotten a new breed of people in, and we've gotten different programs that are available out there that just weren't available, you know, 10 years ago. And I think, I think these programs were designed without the long-term effect in mind.
I think in some ways they probably couldn't know the long-term effect because
no one's ever done it.
That's right. There were new guidelines.
They were new guidelines. Although, I don't know, as a compliance officer and quality control, auditor, I saw the horizon not looking very bright, so
I think maybe what was missing was a common sense element to it.
Yeah.
Just because you could do something doesn't mean maybe you should.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Okay. Are most compliance issues federal or state?
Both. Okay. What I've been seeing in all of the audits that we perform, it is a combination of both state and federal compliance issues. What we've seen over the past 10 years of doing consulting on a nationwide basis is that a lot of lenders and brokers were very eager to go into a lot of different states. And with that, they, for whatever reason, did not realize that they had to comply with different state guidelines along with federal guidelines. So what we were seeing in a lot of our audits were a lot of deficiencies with respect to state disclosures, and timeliness of federal disclosure requirements, you know, such as RESPA and Truth in Lending and that sort of thing. So I would say it's a combination of both. The funny thing about it, though, is that on a state level, the disclosure requirements have a lot more teeth to them than maybe a good faith estimate being inaccurate under RESPA. So we were seeing a lot of refunds and fines and penalties associated more with state compliance than federal.
What is the auditor looking for, and what's the purpose of the audit?
Are you talking the state auditor?
Yes.
Okay. State auditors generally have been trained to do an examination based on regulatory state compliance. And so basically, when they're coming in to review a licensee, they're looking at some federal, and mostly they're focusing on the good faith estimate. Were the fees properly disclosed? Was the good faith estimate done in a timely manner? Was there truth in lending disclosure provided? And basically, a lot of the initial disclosure requirements under federal regulations. But then they also do an extensive review for their state regulations. So depending on the state, depended on the scope of the audit. Some states, actually, New York is one in particular that tends to look at the underwriting of the loans and safety and soundness. So you would kind of see, I would say maybe there was a handful of states, like between 1 to 3 states out there, that somewhat focused on fraud and underwriting guidelines and business practices. But most of the states took more of a compliance regulatory approach to their examinations.
I was going to ask you, how big of a role do you think fraud played in our current situation?
You know, I don't necessarily know that it was big-time fraud. I mean, obviously, we've done some QC files where there were millions of dollars worth of fraud because there were fraud rings involved and that sort of thing. But I think, and I guess if you were to grade fraud as a major and minor fraud,
mm-hmm.
I would say there was a lot of fraud committed with respect to the borrower's income. And that's where we were seeing a lot of issues.
Oh, just state whatever you wish.
State is the income, yeah. I mean, across the board, I'll give you an example. One of the files that we reviewed, we had a box cutter. That was his employment. He was basically a box cutter.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they made him a managing box cutter.
Oh.
So he supervised lots of other box cutters.
Okay.
And he, did a stated income loan and basically made $10,000 a month. Well, when we did the QC review, of course, on a post-closing basis, we didn't... basically, on the QC review, if it's a stated income program, you don't verify the income, but you do have to check the reasonableness. And so, based on our review and everything like that and doing a little bit of research, it was determined that box cutters really only make about, $2,500 a month. So
even the king of box cutters?
Yeah, even though it was king of box cutters.
Okay.
So little situations like that.
Well, you know what's interesting? We had an interview with a mortgage broker, and it was in front of an audience of a couple hundred people in a seminar. And I asked her, where did the stated income number come from?
Mm-hmm.
And honestly goodness, she said in front of an audience of 200, we just made it up.
Yeah.
That was the end of the interview, actually. I said, I guess that's the end.
You go.
I have nothing more I can ask.
Yeah, I guess you got your answer.
On your website, I noticed that I'll quote this, larger profit centers are a byproduct of more marketable loans. What makes a loan more marketable?
I think a loan that is more marketable is definitely one I think it's a bigger picture.
Okay.
I think that it's important, and I think what we're trying to emphasize here is that it's important to have compliance, quality control, and a prudent business plan in place, that it's not just about opening up a shop and doing loads and loads of volume and being very excited that you're making millions of dollars and not having to comply at all. So I think that basically having all of these safety and soundness applications in place make the loan a better product.
It's sort of like there's checks and balances in place. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you can demonstrate that you have a compliance team on board, and you're doing everything that you possibly can to comply with state and federal regulations, you're doing pre-funding QC reviews and post-funding QC reviews, and you've got some really good safety and soundness in place, I think that loan is that much more valuable.
Do you ever have lenders, fund loans? I guess it's on their credit line, and then later they can't sell it to anybody because of something they did wrong?
All the time.
What are some of those things that they might do wrong?
A big one can be appraisal issues.
Okay, I was wondering if that was going to come up.
Yeah, especially lately. One of the big factors that have been coming in to play is declining value.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you have, especially if you're maybe a lender in California and you're not very familiar with the marketplace in another state, and you've got some issues there. I mean, hopefully you're using a good appraisal firm that is going to back you there. But I would say appraisal issues, definitely underwriting issues. I know a lot of the issues were possibly the income not being sufficient for the job.
What's so tough about this time frame is we let everyone in under the most lax standards, mm-hmm. and sort of set them up with an adjustable time bomb. And before it adjusted, we changed the rules to make it much tighter.
Yeah.
It's very tough, even if you had equity to qualify for the same loan, and there's a good chance you don't have equity either.
Right. Yeah. It's such a bad situation because you're right. There was this adjustable rate mortgage that was allowed, which I started in the business in 85, and that's all we knew how to do is ARM loans.
Because you had before that, in 81, you had a fixed rate of 19. So.
Yeah. Nobody wanted to do those. I remember hearing my loan officers, because I was a processor at the time, and I remember how they sold the ARM product, and they sold it so differently than they did today. Today it was like, get in under this ARM loan at 1.25%, and then you can refinance in 3 years, and it's not going to be that big of a deal, but it gets you into the loan. And back in the mid-80s, the product wasn't really sold that way,
Well, it got them into a lot of other things. It got them into a nicer area than they would have been able
sure.
to live in. And they got them into more dollar home. And if your idea was, okay, this $500,000 home is going to be $1 million home, then you would want to stretch and buy the biggest.
Right.
And so that mentality was in place, and it had been working. That's the biggest problem is, when you have a run from 98 to 2005 and nothing bad happens to real estate, all of those participants that got in during those years, they thought that's how it worked.
Right. Right. Not keeping in mind the highs and lows of our economy.
Right. They just thought this is the way real estate works now, permanently.
This is cool.
I don't really know myself, and this is a question I'm sure other people have. The difference between mortgage broker and mortgage banker.
Yeah.
What's the difference between those two?
The difference between a mortgage broker and a mortgage banker is a mortgage broker basically originates the loan. So basically they're going to the public, the consumer, and they are taking the application, originating that transaction, gathering all the documents, if you will, the income, the assets, and then what they do is then they turn it over to a mortgage banker.
Would that be like a Washington Mutual then,
a
banker?
It could be. It could be. A lot of times it was a, a mortgage broker on steroids.
Okay.
And then a lot of times it was, you know, a bona fide true banker, like maybe a Washington Mutual. The differences between a banker and a bank is that a lot of the bankers, which kind of I refer to as brokers on steroids, is that they're not a financial institution. They don't take deposits and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then you have the true bank, like a Washington Mutual, where they are, you know, they do take deposits and they are a financial institution and regulated by the federal government.
Now, is that, okay, I've also heard the read the terms on your website, institutional and non-institutional.
Mm-hmm. So that's exactly, yeah.
The institutional would be the one that takes deposits?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Who decides what the rules are for the mortgage industry?
Well, I think a few, you know, a couple of different entities out there. I think obviously Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set the standards, or did set the standards before the subprime, and then there was no standard until in 06 when ARMOR and CSBS decided to put together some non-traditional guidelines along with teaming up with the OCC and the OTS and other entities out there. But, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has always set the standards. And then, you know, then there's also there's RESPA that you have to comply with, which is governed under HUD. And then there's the, you know, there's Truth in Lending, which is under the Federal Reserve Board. So then you've got a lot of federal governing bodies that represent the federal regulations. And then at the state level, you have a lot of the state regulations. So I think kind of all those entities, you know, have a hand in it.
How were new rules suggested to the powers that be? Let's say you had a really good idea. What would you do?
I guess take it to your local. Well, I mean, a lot of times, you know, it goes to your congressperson, if you will, and a lot of the rules. Well,
it's not easy to change.
It's not. Okay. It's such a convoluted process, you know, and we have a couple of bills that were we thought were going to be passed just recently, and you know, now they're held up, and probably we won't see anything until the next session. But you know, it's so political, and there's so many different groups out there that that lobby, and it's an interesting process. So,
is okay when you people lobby, is it usually on behalf of the consumer or the business, or both sides have their
it's
groups?
Both sides.
Okay,
and depending on who has a stronger lobbyer. you know, wins in a lot of different situations. You know, you have a lot of advocate groups out there that are very, very strong, and they come up with these amazing laws that they want passed. And the bad thing about that is, I mean, obviously they want to protect the consumers, which is good. But then you get to the other side of the spectrum, and they have no idea how the home mortgage lending world works.
Exactly. Now, and I guess that was sort of what I was trying to get to, is that, you know, you're in the business, and you must look at some of these things and go, that's really not going to have the outcome you think it is.
It's amazing. Some of the laws that go into effect, you know, a lot of lenders and banks had to pull out of a lot of states for a while. For example, Georgia passed a predatory lending law several years ago, and many banks and many lending institutions had to pull out of the state because there was no way to comply with the laws. And that happens pretty often. And then what happens is when the consumers don't have access to credit, then they go in and they reamend, you know, the first round,
mm-hmm.
and they come back with a version two, you know, a new improved law, and hopefully everybody can comply with that. But there's some pretty strange laws out there that have to be complied with, and what I find a lot of our clients, they just Most lenders and brokers they just want to know, tell me what to do, and we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets very convoluted and nobody knows what the left hand or the right hand is doing, then it's very discouraging for them. So,
I noticed on your website you have a mortgage compliance guide.
Uh-huh.
How big is that thing if it's the national version?
Oh, I think it's about 2,000 pages.
Oh, boy. It reminds me of the IRS code book or something like that.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that with the passage of H.R. 3221 that probably will change a few pages in that book?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
And how quickly does that have to get implemented in the field? I mean, if they change things, is it literally next week there's new rules?
Now, just remind me, 3221.
That's the Bush is going to be signing, and it's going to have a lot to do with lenders having a choice to end up taking a short sale from FHA.
Oh, yeah. Again, this is a whole new ballpark for the industry. Probably about 15, back probably in 1992, foreclosures were pretty, we were doing a lot of foreclosures and REOs and that sort of thing. And people, maybe even a little bit earlier than that. But, there were people out there that knew what to do in servicing, knew what to do with respect to foreclosures, REOs, loss mitigation, loan modifications and that sort of thing. Now we have a whole new breed of people. And no one knows how to handle this, and especially the volume. So with the passage of that, it's just going to be a whole new learning curve, I think, for a lot of people as well, just understanding the language,
sure,
of all of that and having to comply.
Schwarzenegger just signed in a new role, too, and that had to do with the process of allowing people some choices that they never had in the foreclosure.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit more familiar with that bill than the other one from Bush.
It hasn't even been signed yet, so you're forgiven. It's
yeah,
okay.
I you wouldn't believe the reading I have to do, and a lot of times if I feel like, oh my gosh, I think it's going to pass, or we get feedback from some of the trade groups that we belong to and stuff like that, I'll submerge myself into it. But what happens is there's thousands of bills, and they never wind up getting passed, and then you spin all your wheels on.
And they change. There's at least three or four versions of this.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
You might as well wait till it becomes a hard copy before you may spend all that time.
Yeah.
We only have a couple more minutes.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you a question about how the industry looks at non-owner-occupied loans. And here's why I asked that.
Mm-hmm.
The lending programs that were in place in 2005 and 2006 allowed a lot of people to own a house that never had before, and I think we're finding out that maybe not all of them should have.
Right.
So I think the percentage of home ownership is going to decline.
Yes.
And yet I see the practices of lenders tightening the programs for the investors who would make those fixed rentals.
Right.
So I just wonder how the industry looks at the non-owner-occupied loans at this point from a risk point.
It's still very high risk,
And does the history bear them out? Is that true?
Yes.
Is it correct?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they're priced higher always, non-owner occupied, and basically because of risk. It's always treated differently. I'll give you an example. Like the state of Virginia doesn't even regulate non-owner occupied. So if you're a licensee, in the state of Virginia and you're making a non-owner-occupied loan, they wouldn't even, and that maybe that's all you did is non-owner-occupied, they wouldn't even regulate you.
means you can charge whatever you want?
Basically, there are a couple of little provisions in there, but you would not be regulated under the state of Virginia. So,
well, you know what? Honestly, we're almost out of time.
Sure.
I wanted to make sure to get your website in.
Yeah.
Please go ahead and give us your website.
It's www.thecompliancegroup.net. Oh. And then we also have our licensing side, which is www.mymortgagelicense.com.
All right. Anna Maria Allen, we are so glad you joined us today, and I'm looking forward to seeing you August 23rd.
Great. Thank you very much, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.